KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we talk with the person in charge of all things transportation in San Francisco. Ed Riskin is Director of Transportation at the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. He oversees muni, bicycling, parking, taxis, also major construction projects like the Central Subway and the recent repairs to the Twin Peaks Tunnel. Riskin will share his priorities and take your questions, so join us on Forum after this news. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. And in this hour, we open the phone lines to take your questions and comments for San Francisco's Transportation Director, Ed Riskin. As head of the San Francisco Metropolitan Transportation Agency, it's Riskin's job to make sure the muni bus system is reliable, to manage traffic and parking, and to ensure bicycle riders and pedestrians can move safely on city streets. He also oversees major construction projects. So what have been your experiences using San Francisco's transportation system? And what would you like to ask or tell Ed Riskin? The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us with your questions at forum@kqed.org or post them on Facebook or Twitter. Ed Riskin, welcome back to Forum, and thanks for taking the time to join us today and respond to listener questions.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, to say you have a big job is an understatement. I described some of the things that you're responsible for, and with all that you are responsible for, how do you define your core mandate?
Well, the charter really established the agency, established the position of director of transportation, and therein provided the mandate, which really is to implement the city's transit first policy, which is to prioritize transit and other more sustainable means of getting around San Francisco. This was a policy that was actually developed back in 1973 and adopted by the Board of Supervisors. So I think it had its roots in the oil crisis of the early 70s. But was later placed in the charter when the agency was put together that took the functions of Muni and the old Department of Parking and Traffic and put it together in one place so that we could really think about and plan for and manage the transportation system in a coordinated way in order to actually really meet the goals of the Transit First policy.
Which is made for a very big agency. It's for you to oversee.
It is.
But also, then, how do you define that charter, right? How do you set your priorities? When you came in 2011, what is it that you wanted to accomplish specifically?
Well, so the primary way that we implement the Transit First policy is by improving muni service, by making it more reliable, to making the trips quicker so that it's a better option for more people for more trips. It's not all about muni, but muni really is the backbone of the system and of the agency. And that the more people that we can get using transit, the less congestion that we'll have on our streets, the less pollution in the air. So focusing on muni improvement is a big part of it. Focusing on bike and pedestrian safety is a big part of it because we want people to feel safe walking and biking in our city, which often is a complement to taking transit in our city. Also more sustainable trips, also fewer people in cars. So and this, you know, that focus on safety predated the city's adoption of Vision Zero. But improving muni reliability and making the streets safer were really then and now the main goals of mine and of the agency.
And Vision Zero, of course, is the goal to end traffic deaths.
Right, to eliminate traffic fatalities in the city by 2024.
And it's been a rough week with regard to that goal, considering the fact that I think in the last couple of weeks you've had two fatalities and several injuries, some major injuries.
Yeah, as of this morning, now three.
Oh.
This morning, there was a person on a bicycle that was struck and killed by a truck at 6th and Howard. So it's been awful. It's been really devastating. In the last week or so, as you say, a number of serious and fatal collisions, at least three people in the city have lost their lives just trying to get to where they were going. And there's another couple who were seriously injured to the point where they may not make it either. And that's just unacceptable.
And there have been a lot of plans for implementing safer streets under Vision Zero, but a lot of the complaints have been that they're just not being implemented quickly enough.
Well, so we're never doing this work as fast as I or probably anybody else would like it. That, you know, some of this work is complex, but, you know, as an example, at 6th and Howard, where this morning somebody was killed, we just recently put in a protected bike lane on Howard from maybe 5th out to 11th. We had previously made some improvements on 6th Street in that same corridor. Those were, though, temporary improvements. We recently had the MTA Board of Directors approve a more permanent project to try to further address safety along 6th Street. So we have been able to achieve a lot. There's no way to fully design out every type of activity that could lead to a collision. What we're trying, you know, people make mistakes when they're out on the road. What we're trying to do through redesigning the streets is make it less likely that those mistakes will end up in somebody being seriously hurt or killed. And tragically, despite what we've done on Howard, which is pretty significant, the buffered bike lane and the initial steps we've taken on 6th Street, somebody was killed there today.
Well, speaking of making improvements fast enough, and this would also apply to Muni, and Muni is what you mentioned right off the bat. I mean, it feels like it is, in fact, doesn't just feel like the public perception of Muni is that it's terrible or that it's fraught with problems. Muni sucks seems to be a very common refrain. I mean, do you think that's a fair characterization?
So first of all, when we survey our riders, more than 60% say that they're satisfied with Muni. So the people who actually use it, and we look at people who use it frequently and infrequently, you know, the majority are satisfied with it. So I wouldn't agree with the characterization that everybody thinks it's awful. But it's not reliable. And, you know, as someone who rides it every day, you know, most days and most trips, it works great for me. But when it doesn't, it can be extremely frustrating when you're trying to get somewhere and the train is broken down or the bus isn't coming. You know, that's what people remember. And that's really the work for us to do, is to make it reliable, because some people will not take it because they can't rely on it always being there and in getting to where they're going in a reasonable time. And that's where the frustration comes, and that's where phrases like Muni suck might come from. Even if it's a minority of the time that it happens, you know, it's extremely frustrating when it doesn't work for you.
Sure. And that is, those types of problems understandably happen on a system as big and complex as Muni. But there was, you know, last summer, for example, the Twin Peaks tunnel repairs where, you know, in that particular case, it did feel like that was something that on a management level could have been handled better to have helped, you know, mitigate the issues that you had with driver shortages, people waiting incredibly long to get on buses, to be able to get from one place to another. I mean, is there anything that you want to say to folks who still feel like there hasn't been a full accounting for what happened?
Yeah, well, we certainly tried to make a full accounting for what happened. And you're right, that we could not have fully mitigated the impact of losing a major rail tunnel. I mean, that tunnel is there for a reason, because it allows us to move a large amount of people in a very efficient way. And so when we don't have access to that tunnel, which we didn't because we had necessary work to do to upgrade the infrastructure, which is part of the long-term plans to improve reliability, we didn't plan as well as we could have to ramp up to mitigate for the loss of that tunnel. So
in terms of ensuring that there were enough drivers, that there were...
Right. Right. So again, we would not have been able to fully mitigate. We can't compensate for the loss of a tunnel, but we could have done better and we should have done better. And I've accepted full responsibility for that. And hindsight, I see now where we fell short there. And as we know, we're moving into things, you know, currently we have the 3rd Street shut down and we're able to, you know, learn from the past and plan for that. And we're not getting the same kind of complaints. As a matter of fact, people on 3rd Street who are now taking a bus, we're getting very few complaints, and the rest of the service we've been able to maintain and manage. So, yeah, the criticism is fair. It's hard to fix something while you're operating it, but we definitely could have and should have done better.
Do you think the criticism is fair in terms of the contractor that you went with after the death of Patrick Ricketts, the Shimmick Construction, in terms of their safety violations and not being vetted well enough?
So we went back and we re-reviewed their safety record. And the way that the language in our contracts reads is that it looks for willful and negligent violations from a contractor. And while they had some pending complaints at Cal OSHA, the state entity that oversees these kind of industrial accidents, they did not meet a threshold that would have been problematic. They have generally been a good contractor. They work for many transit agencies and other public entities around the region. We've never had a bad experience with them. So I mean, it was a tragic accident, and there were definitely things that were done wrong in that specific instance, and they actually were just cited, I believe, by Cal OSHA. But I don't believe that a more thorough vetting process would have disqualified them from doing the work.
Ed Riskin is Director of Transportation for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, and we are taking your questions about transportation, and we're starting with John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi there. Hi, Director Riskin. Your negligence on protected bike lanes and high-injury corridors, particularly District 6, is killing people on bikes in San Francisco, including one this morning. I was on a bike at the time of the injury, in fact, only blocks away on Fulton, where I had to swerve to avoid an Uber blocking the bike lane on the north side of Alamo Square, because, of course, TNCs block bike lanes. Everybody knows it, but without curbs and concrete or metal bollards, it will never stop. I'm curious how many people on bikes need to be killed by dangerously inadequate infrastructure before you're willing to remove street parking in favor of bike lanes. We've got 900 miles of street parking in San Francisco and something like 12 miles of protected bike lanes in Mesquite County. This is a massive inequity with grievous consequences for cyclists, pedestrians, and the climate.
John,
thank you.
Thanks. That's a provocative question. Ed Riskin, your response to John.
Yeah, thanks, John. And I'm sorry that for your experience this morning and swerving around an Uber. I have had that experience myself on bikes. When riding a bike. So we have invested quite a bit, particularly in District 6 in the South of Market area. We've put protected bike lanes on Folsom, on Howard, on 7th, on 8th, recently on Townsend. Those are some of the routes that carry the highest amounts of bike traffic. So we have been working hard to try to get these protected bike lanes in. We've done other pretty significant upgrades of bike infrastructure. Last year, I finished the Masonic project, just about to finish the Polk Street project. Second Street is under construction. Different kinds of facilities on the different streets. But the landscape for riding a bike in San Francisco has changed pretty dramatically, I would say, in the last 5 or 6 years. It's gotten a lot safer, but there's no question there's more work to do.
Well, this listener tweets, bike lane projects can take so long to go from idea to implementation that by the time they're in the ground, their design is outdated and the safety intents watered down. For example, Masonic Avenue. What is Riskin doing to speed up street safety project implementation? Is there something specific you can point to?
Yeah. So what we've done on Folsom and Howard, for example, are in advance of a longer capital project. So the way we used to do things, Masonic being an example, is we would go through planning and design, and then go through the construction process before we make the changes. What we're doing now, and what we've done, for example, on Folsom and Howard and on Townsend, is we've once we're done with the planning, we go and do essentially a temporary implementation of the changes. So before taking the time to fully finish the design and bid the contract and do all the construction work, we're essentially using paint and signage and temporary materials to try to get these improvements on the ground faster. And for example, on 6th Street, some of the what we call a painted safety zone, which essentially is extending the sidewalk at the intersections so pedestrians are more visible and have a shorter crossing distance, that those were also done in the same manner with paint and bollards and signage. So we're not waiting for the very long lead time that it takes to actually do street construction in San Francisco.
Well, let's hear next from Monty in San Francisco. Hi, Monty.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
So there's a whole new function that didn't exist before of people driving personal vehicles to make deliveries in the gig economy that the government, state, local, and federal doesn't seem to be planning for. and that is people using their personal vehicles to deliver food, documents, and a whole list of other things in neighborhoods that have no legal option for them to function in. Like the financial district, there's no place to park legally to make a delivery unless you're in a van, a commercial van or a commercial vehicle, and very often a truck with three axles. So I really want to see planning for new innovative businesses like courier services that need to be planned for. Thank you.
Monty, thanks. Parking, that's definitely been a very contentious issue as well in terms of losing parking spaces for maybe some of the goals that you want to accomplish with regard to mass transit. Can you respond to Monty's concern?
Yeah, so Monty's right. There's a lot of different ways that private vehicles are being used. He mentioned for food delivery and courier services, obviously a huge way they're being used is to ferry other people around, such as in Uber and Lyft. And so we have tens of thousands of more vehicles on our streets, which is itself a concern. But the existing parking regulations don't necessarily work. So these companies have developed business models and deployed them on our streets, but they don't really work with our existing parking laws. So we are, to the extent we can, trying to mitigate and adjust for that. We're developing a new curb management strategy that really acknowledges the fact that the old way of using a curb, you park your personal car and store it there on the street while you go and do something, is changing. And now a lot of people are just dipping into a curb for a quick drop-off or to deliver a package or food and then leaving. And Monty's right, our regulations don't really work for that right now.
Are you engaging the companies directly as well that you feel like are sort of flouting the city's laws?
We've made some efforts in that regard. We haven't gotten a whole lot of receptivity, but we do recognize that between what used to be a traditional yellow zone for a commercial vehicle to park and do loading, or a white zone, which is for passenger loading, these kind of things that Monty are talking about don't quite fit into either one of those buckets. So we're looking at new kinds of curb regulations to try to safely accommodate these new business models.
And how soon could those regulations be implemented?
So we should have the beginnings of them out this year.
Well, Bobak says, when are we going to stop prioritizing car travel in this city over the expense of everyone else? What is your philosophy behind how to balance transit and cars in a city like San Francisco?
Well, so we do have, as I said, the transit first policy, which is in the charter. So the people of San Francisco have put that in the charter to say that we should be prioritizing transit and other sustainable modes of transportation like bikes. So you heard the first caller talking about how we're not doing enough in that regard. But we are absolutely looking to prioritize those because that is our charter mandate. It relates not just to transportation policy, but advances the city's climate policy goals. And we have a goal in the city for 80% of the trips in San Francisco by 2030 to be made by sustainable modes of transportation. Today, we're at about 55%. So we have a long way to go there. The Board of Supervisors are now talking about declaring a climate emergency in the city, which might really accelerate the work there. There are equity impacts of prioritizing transit over other means of transportation, especially given that we make Muni free for low and moderate income seniors, youth, people with disabilities, and give a half price off for low income folks. We also see a concentration of car crashes, serious and fatal car crashes, in poorer neighborhoods of San Francisco. So we are absolutely prioritizing transit and more sustainable modes of transportation. But ultimately, we're not banning cars. We don't currently have the ability to price the roadway other than with a parking meter. So there's still a lot of cars on the street.
You'll continue on the track, though, of it will be harder. Drivers should expect that it will be harder for them to drive in, heavily trafficked corridors from now on, and they should start preparing for that.
That's right. San Francisco is projected to add another couple hundred thousand people in the next 20 years. And a lot of jobs. There's more people who want to live here, work here, and visit here. It's not going to be easier to drive, particularly in downtown San Francisco.
And you pointed to the reduced fare, the free fares for youth that on Muni. That has been an accomplishment, I would say, that you could point to quite confidently, that it has helped with creating more equity in the city.
Yeah, I think so. I think
that
it's huge.
Has been a lauded project.
I think between the free fares for youth, seniors, and people with disabilities, we have something like 80,000 San Franciscans registered in that program. That's almost one in every 10 people in the city who are now able to ride Muni for free. And in a place where the cost of living is becoming so challengingly high, and with transportation being the kind of number two biggest item in a household budget, the fact that we're able to help so many San Franciscans get around for free is that, yeah, it's a pretty significant accomplishment. So I give great credit to my board and the Board of Supervisors and the current and past mayors for supporting that.
And Anna tweets, "I'm satisfied with Muni because I'm disabled and it's free, but it takes me an hour to get anywhere from the Excelsior. I have to plan to be 30 minutes early in case my bus doesn't come. I lose many hours a day because of Muni." Bob writes, "As a senior citizen, I feel unsafe and scared on most Muni buses. I live in the Central District and find the buses filthy, crowded, and usually have at least several very unstable folks on the bus. What does Muni have planned to try and make the buses safer and cleaner?"
Yeah, so to the first point, we are doing more in terms of dedicating street space for Muni and putting signal priority in place so that the buses are talking to the traffic signals, so the signals will hold a green light for the bus to go through to try to deal with the issue of unreliability, such as getting in from the Excelsior. Right now, when you come through the Mission, it's a much quicker ride because we've made some of those improvements. And we're right now working with folks in the Excelsior to improve the bus travel, the reliability of the travel for the 14 line through the Excelsior. So we're trying to make changes in the way we design the streets and operate the service to make the service more reliable so people don't have to add an extra half hour for each trip. I know I buffer my trips always by about 15 minutes because of that unreliability, so I know what Anna's talking about. And as to safety, it's definitely been a challenge. Our actually reported crime on Muni is down over where it had been, but a lot of the challenging behaviors that we're seeing out on our streets and sidewalks, they Muni is public space. So what we see out on the streets, we also see on Muni. So there are certainly people with mental health and other challenges that we see on our buses. We're working hard with the police department and our own staff to make sure that everybody can get around safely on Muni.
We're talking with Ed Riskin, Director of Transportation for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. He's responsible for Muni trains and buses, parking policy, taxi regulation, bicycle and pedestrian safety. What are your comments, compliments, concerns about transportation in the city? What would you like to ask him? You can call us at 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or tweet your comments at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim, another half hour with Ed Riskin. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Ed Riskin, who's been overseeing transportation in San Francisco since 2011 as director of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. He's responsible for the planning, building, operation, regulation, and maintenance of the transportation network. And all of that is what he wants to talk with you about today and answer your questions about it. And we're going to go straight to Robin in San Francisco. Hi, Robin.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, so hi, Director Riskin. So I'm aware that one of our major projects right now is planning for the next procurement of light rail vehicles in San Francisco, and you've already had one procurement, and you're now looking at the next one. My question is about something that is in the current rail cars but is not in the new ones, and that is the complete lack of forwards, backwards facing seats, also called transfer seats. I think there are three groups that really would benefit from that. Disabled people need the forwards, backwards seats in order to sit in because many cannot stand or sit. So that's one major group that's being, eliminated right now. Second, regular folks find the forwards-backwards seats more comfortable for back support. And the third reason is, in the case of a sudden stop, we think that the forwards-backwards seats are the only seats that will stop people's motion. Otherwise, in the open setting, people will go flying, and I think there will be a lot more injuries. So I was wondering what your thoughts are about adding back in an adequate number of forwards-backwards seats for these reasons.
Robin, thank you for the question. And this has definitely been a big recent issue, and you have undertaken getting feedback about this. And I'm sure you've heard comments like Robin's.
We've heard comments like Robin's, and I've experienced this myself and riding the new trains. The new trains are great by and large, and folks have been pretty happy with them, with one exception, and that's the seats. And so Robin is right on. We've heard that comment from a lot of people across the city. So we are very much looking at changing the seating arrangement to add more of the forward and backward facing seats. So we'll probably end up, we're going through an outreach process, and I encourage folks to go to our website, sfmta.com, if they want to weigh in. But we are undertaking outreach to kind of figure out what the actual final design will be. But I'm certain, I can say with confidence at this point, it will involve a mix of the sideways seats and the forward and backward facing seats. And for the sideways ones, and for all of them, we'll also be lowering them, which is another complaint that we've heard. And we'll be individualizing.
So they were too high for people who say we're 5'4 or less.
Right. Actually, they're too high for a lot more folks. Mm-hmm. But right, when we surveyed folks, it was the shorter folks who really had a problem with them. And we'll also be individualizing the seats because right now it's just a smooth, slippery bench. And as Robin indicated, when the train starts or stops quickly, which it sometimes needs to do, that feeling of sliding back and forth is not comfortable for folks. So we'll be lowering the seats, individualizing them, and changing the design so at least some of them will be forward and backward facing.
Well, one of the concerns about changing the design of the seats is that it could slow down new trains coming online. How much could it affect that for people who are anxious to get these rail cars?
So we're very eager to get these on, not just because the new trains are nicer, but because the old trains are becoming increasingly unreliable and more difficult and expensive to maintain. So we are trying to prioritize options, and we got this direction from our board of directors on Tuesday that will not slow down the replacement of the trains. We have a procurement already in place. This isn't a new procurement. It's just a continuation. We have a design in place, and we think, and we've talked to the manufacturer, that they can accommodate a redesign of the interior without slowing down the replacement.
Well, Robin, thanks for the question. Let me go next to Rob. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Just a quick follow-up comment and then my main comment. On the Muni cars, the new light rail, the new streetcars, the seats are very uncomfortable. It's the molded shape of them that doesn't go into your back like the old seats used to be, and they take off and stop so abruptly compared to the old streetcars. They just jerk you right out of your skin almost. So I wonder if that could be dampened a little bit. But my main question is about people that still need to drive. I feel like we're becoming malign and some kind of evil people that we still need our personal vehicles. I'm not going to go down to Costco on the bus. It takes me 2 to 3 hours as it is to get through traffic. And all these traffic calming islands and speed bumps everywhere that are designed, I know, to slow people down and make it so we have fewer pedestrian fatalities, and everyone is for that. But couldn't we have like a public service campaign that really targets people's driving habits? Because there's a lot of jerks out there. Some of this could be due to people using their cell phones and being distracted driving. We go after that, make people aware that this is killing people, and put some kind of limitations on the number of ride shares that are in their city. They're clogging our streets. They're making people say, hey, I don't want to take Muni. I'd rather take a car share. So then everybody does that, and then you lose out on Muni, like people are finding out. So please consider the personal car drivers. Still live in San Francisco. We still need to use our cars occasionally and go downtown and find a parking spot, because we can't just whip in and whip out. We need to go in, make deliveries that take more than a couple of minutes. Please don't forget about us, because we are still a vibrant part of the city.
Rob, thank you. I can let Rob's comments stand unless you want to respond.
I'll agree with with Rob. There are still people who will want to drive in the city, who will need to drive in the city, and that, I think, will always be the case. And we're trying to accommodate all road users. And, you know, frankly, the more people that we can get onto the bus, the less traffic there's going to be for Rob and others who want to drive. The issue of limiting the number of Ubers and Lyfts in the city is something that I would very much like to do, but the state legislature has preempted me and anyone else in any other city around the state from doing so. So the fact that we have tens of thousands of these vehicles on our streets and no way to regulate them is very much frustrating. And then just lastly, with regard to educating drivers, it's something that we are doing actively as part of our Vision Zero efforts. We've done ads on Drive Time Radio. We have billboards and posters up around the city targeting not just drivers, but all road users, because the education and the behavioral change is really a big part of our being able to get to zero.
And just a couple of quick examples of what are on these signs and billboards to educate drivers and others.
So it could be about distraction, as Rob mentioned. A lot of what our focus on is speed, on asking people to slow down and educating people on how exponentially more dangerous it is to drive fast. The primary collision factor in most of our serious and fatal collisions is speed. We did some drive time radio around daylight savings time, you know, back in the fall, reminding people it's going to get dark, be more careful and be more aware when they're driving.
Well, Jim in San Francisco, you have a question for Ed Riskin.
Good morning. Hello, Ed. I just out of disclosure, I did work with you about a decade ago. I did 31 years at the San Francisco Police Department. It was before you went to MTA and worked on several projects under Mayor Newsom. My issue is regarding citations issued by mini buses. In January 18th, I received in the mail a violation of a bus zone violation for $288 at a location that would have put me on Market at Laguna facing westbound. I had no recollection of being there. I checked with my kids. I did recall being on Market at 7th, where I dropped my son off, which can be verified on his Google Maps. And when I went to the website, there's a link to a picture with the citation. And the picture clearly shows my vehicle going a mile east of the violation in a lane of traffic, number two lane, number one is a muni lane, in at a crosswalk to make a right onto 6th Street. So there is no bus zone at that location. The muni lane is the number one lane. And basically, this is a phantom, as far as I can tell, a phantom citation. I wrote my first citation in a bus zone 40 years ago. So I'm trying to find out or understand what my violation is. Why would I be paying $288? The vehicle's in a lane of traffic. It's not parked. So I don't understand what's going on. What kind of review is in your organization to verify that citations by muni are checked for verification that the proper location? Number two, do they even meet the elements of the violation? So that's my concern.
Jim, thank you. And I don't know if you can respond to Jim's specific case, but he isn't alone in people saying that it is very difficult to be able to challenge their citations, to understand the process that the MTA goes through to determine whether or not they are guilty of the violation or innocent of the violation. There's also a lot of frustration, which I think Jim is alluding to as well, about the cost of citations and fines in the city. Can you shed any light on that process and why it feels so opaque to people?
I can try. So first of all, thanks, Jim, for your 31 years of service to the city, and you certainly know what you're talking about when it comes to writing citations. So first of all, the reason that we have parking and traffic laws is to facilitate the movement and the safety of traffic. And parking in a bus zone, for example, the reason that that's so expensive is because the impact of that can be so significant. One person in a car at a bus stop can hold up dozens of people on a bus from being able to get to where they're going. So we have the cost of citations high because we want to discourage the behavior. Our purpose is not to get people cited and get money out of their wallet. It's to have them obey by the rules so that everyone can get around safely. With regard to the forward-facing cameras on the buses that issue some of our citations for violations of transit-only lanes, they are every single one of them is validated by an enforcement officer. The California state law requires that. So we do make sure that everyone is verified. Doesn't mean that a mistake might not be made once in a while, and there is a process. I think the information on the back of the citation and on the website is actually pretty clear. We've tried to make it easier for folks. They can protest now online. There's numerous stages of review. If you don't succeed in your first protest, you can go to one or two more levels of protest. So we try to give a lot of due process, because for as great as our enforcement officers are, people are going to make mistakes. Protests are upheld in a number of cases, and we try to make it as fair and transparent as possible.
It still takes a couple months, though, right, to typically get a response.
No,
6 to 8 weeks.
No, I don't think it should take that long. I'll have to check on that.
Well, this listener tweets, when are we going to create taxi stand style loading zones for taxis and ride hailing companies to pick up and drop off folks without double parking? You could achieve this by eliminating one parking space per block.
Yeah, so this is a little bit like what we talked about earlier. People are using the curb in different ways now, less for storing their vehicle and more for being dropped off or picked up from a vehicle. So we're looking at doing just that.
Well, Julia writes, many San Franciscans feel they don't get enough results from our spending on transit. What are the most and least efficient areas of spending on transit? How are you working to increase transparency around how muni funds are used?
Well, you know, as a public
question.
It's a big question and it's a good question. As a public agency, all of our spending, our budget, our expenditures, everything is out there for the public to review. We have used, I think, the public's money, and you know, I take the stewardship of that money as a very solemn responsibility that we have, and we've used it well. We've replaced almost all of the muni buses, so all of the buses pretty much are now new. By the end of this year, we'll be almost done with that process. We're replacing the trains. We're upgrading the infrastructure, such as the rails in the Twin Peaks Tunnel, and before that in the Sunset Tunnel.
And forgive me, are you also updating the computer network that runs the trains, especially the ones that go underground?
Right. So when the trains are in the subway, they're run by a computer system. It's called the Automated Train Control System, and we have been upgrading that system. We've upgraded the radio system. There was a lot of old technology in Muni, so we're making a lot of investments that, you know, some of which the rider sees and some of which the rider doesn't, but it helps us manage the system better and makes it more reliable. So we've had, you know, I'd say, you know, record investment in Muni over the last 5 years or so, and really starting to manifest itself and seeing the new buses, the new trains, the upgraded infrastructure, and a lot of investment out on the streets that people are seeing, too, to make the streets safer.
And is this figure right, that there's a projected $22 billion needed for capital investments in transportation infrastructure by 2040 for all the things that you'd like to do that you think the city needs?
Yeah. So Mayor Lee convened a group of folks a number of years ago. It was called the Transportation 2030 Task Force. And then he reconvened them a few years later with Supervisor Peskin, who's chair of the Transportation Authority Commission, to look at what are the needs of the transportation system out to 2045. And that might be where that $22 billion number comes from. We have a lot of aging infrastructure. The building right across the street from here was built in 1915, and it's not adequate to the task that we have for it. We're adding more and more buses into the system. That facility is not seismically in the condition that we want it to be in. It's not conducive to efficient work environment. We have facilities like that all over the city. And while we've done some rail replacements that I just mentioned, there's lots more rail in the city that needs to be upgraded. So if you look at all of those needs of the existing system and the system that we will need to accommodate the growth in population in the city, it's billions of dollars that we're short. We right now have a healthy $1.2 billion annual operating budget. But we have structural deficits, both in operating and particularly in capital, that if we're really going to bring the system up to the condition that it needs to be and expand it to accommodate all the people that are planning to come to San Francisco, it will take considerably more investment.
We're talking with Ed Riskin, Director of Transportation for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, and with you, our listeners. Your questions and comments for Ed Riskin, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments as well on our website, on Facebook, on Twitter at KQED Forum, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. I'll go next to another Jim in San Francisco. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd like to ask Mr. Riskin. He's acknowledged that the city, can't regulate Uber and Lyft because state has taken that over jurisdiction of that. And he's also acknowledged that his agency needs money. They need money. My is. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Jim, go ahead.
Okay. My comment and question.
Jim, I think we're going to have to try you again. Let's see. Adem tweets, what the heck is going on with Van S? Why? Lots of H's and Y's and a question mark in that Y. I'm assuming he's talking about all the construction that's going on there and the lane changes.
Yeah, so a very good question.
Or she. Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised we didn't get that sooner. So the Van Ness Corridor is obviously a very important north-south corridor in the city. It's also a state highway. And we have a project that ultimately will put dedicated lanes for the transit buses, both Muni and Golden Gate Transit, in the center of Van Ness, and will significantly improve safety. Van Ness is on the high injury network, which are the 13% of streets in San Francisco that are home to 75% of serious and fatal collisions. And we had a couple people killed on Van Ness a few years back. So very significant transit and safety upgrades that are what this project is about. But before we get to those, we're replacing all of the 100-year-old infrastructure under the ground. So there's a 100-year-old sewer. There are old water pipes. We have a high-pressure water system for firefighting in the city. We're replacing some of those pipes as well. And all of that utility work is the work that people are seeing happen right now. And we do shift the lanes around so that we can move traffic out of the way so that we can work on the street. And then when we're done with that part, we shift the lane so that we can continue the work. So we appreciate everyone's patience and understand everyone's impatience for this work. But we will be, at the end of this project, we'll have brand new infrastructure under the street and a much safer and better looking and more enjoyable and better transit on the surface of the street.
Well, Terry writes, first, as a Muni rider, I'm grateful for the bus and train service. Thank you for your work, and I completely agree with your comment that Uber and Lyft need to be regulated. They clog streets, pollute, and interfere with buses. Please explain the benefit from the hugely expensive tunnel to Chinatown when it is a quick walk from downtown there.
So the Central Subway, which is the tunnel to Chinatown, is phase two of the T3rd light rail project. The first phase opened in 2007. Connecting Viz Valley up with the downtown. And the T3rd project was envisioned to connect the most densely populated and the fastest growing parts of San Francisco. So from Viz Valley to Bayview, Dogpatch, Mission Bay, and then into South of Market, that's where the growth in San Francisco is happening. And then it connects to the newly expanded convention center, to Union Square and to Chinatown, which is the most densely populated neighborhood in San Francisco. Right now, if Terry, I don't know if she ever has an opportunity to ride the 30 or the 45 or the 8 going down Stockton Street,
yes,
you'll see there's far beyond capacity. There's no way that we can move folks to and from Chinatown, to and from Union Square and to the southeast part of the city with the bus network. So that's the purpose of the subway, that the day that it opens, it will be the most heavily used.
And that day will be
transit line in the city. Our current schedule projects December of this year. I will say that there's a lot of risk to that schedule, so it may well slip into next year. But we're the light's at the end of the tunnel, so to speak.
No pun intended.
And it will be a very well and heavily used part of the transit system in San Francisco.
That project has been beset by a perception that it's over budget, behind schedule, and then there have been questions about the usefulness. I hope, Terry, that we have been able to address that for you, Darnell.
And it's not over budget.
And to clarify that, Darnell asks, when will Muni Light Rail become a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week system? It would be so much better and convenient.
Yeah, so the answer is probably never. The reason is, and this is the reason that BART shuts down at night too, and now even longer, is that we need time to do maintenance in the subway. There's a lot of infrastructure in the subway. There's signals, there's switches, there's the overhead wire and the rails and all of the ties. All that infrastructure, when it's not maintained, it breaks down, and that's what creates reliability problems. So one is that we need time to maintain the system. Earlier, you had asked about efficiency. Our ridership on the light rail system, or generally in the system, gets very, very light at night. People still use it, and that's why we have the OWL service running all night long. But it would not be an efficient use of public funds to run those trains all night long with just a couple people on it. We can serve that ridership much more efficiently with buses. It's not maybe as fast as the train, but that's the kind of trade-off that we need to make.
Well, Marcia writes, please ask who might we direct our concerns to get state legislators to create laws regulating the number of rideshare vehicles on the road, or presumably allowing cities to do that, which is what you were saying has been one of the obstacles to your ability to do that in San Francisco.
Yeah, I guess I would just urge you to contact your representatives in the state and the state Senate and the state assembly. You know, ultimately, it's going to be under their authority that any change to that preemption that they put in place about 6 years ago would be made. And it may be that for most parts of the state, the way this current regulatory structure works. But for large cities like San Francisco, it's just not working for us.
Well, John in San Francisco, join us.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering why, when we have all these red zones for buses, which I think does improve efficiency, are they not monitored by some sort of enforcement? I see people riding or driving in them all the time to circumvent the line to get onto the freeway or to get around on Geary or what have you to get to where they're going faster. And there's nobody stopping these people or giving them a fine.
Yeah, John, it's a great question. And it's a frustration I share. We do find that the transit-only lanes, particularly when they are painted red, the voluntary compliance on them is pretty good. That varies some depending on where the lane is in the city, but we still find a benefit to them, even though we all do see people violating them. Do know, though, that as we talked with a previous caller about, we do have forward-facing cameras on our buses, and they can issue citations to people who are violating the red lane. Our cameras can enforce on violations of people parked in the lane. Moving violations, we do need the police department. We do work with the police department to let them know where we're seeing problems and to prioritize enforcement. And they do get out there. And though you don't see them maybe often, they do write a good number of transit-only lane violation citations. So it's something that we're continuing to work with them on, but we do find the red lanes pretty effective.
Well, let me take one more Muni comment here. John writes, one of the worst choke points in the Muni system is the tunnel near DeBose and Church, where the N Judah line runs between downtown and the Sunset District. During the afternoon commute hours, there are frequent interruptions in service because of track problems in this tunnel. Is Mr. Riskin aware of this problem? If so, why hasn't it been fixed?
Yeah, so we have replaced the two switches where the DeBose branch breaks off of the splits off of the main line. That's what the N and the J take to get off of the main line and up out of DeBose. So the upgrade of those switches, as well as some replacement of some very old wiring, is helping to improve that situation. The Church and DeBose intersection itself is a complex one. We have the J going one way, the N going another way. We have the 22 cutting across, and it's a major bike corridor connecting from downtown to the Wiggle, as well as the pedestrian traffic there. So when the trains do, even when the subway infrastructure is working right, when the trains get up there, it can be a little bit slow to get them out of the portal and out of the way for the next train to come. But he's right. It's a bottleneck, and that and West Portal, we're very much focused on making improvements to.
So you came to SFMTA, some 8 years ago from Public Works.
Right.
You've called being director of transportation your dream job. still your dream job, Ed Riskin?
Still is. I still feel very lucky and honored to be able to do this work. As you can hear from the callers, transportation really matters to people. It really impacts their lives and their livelihoods. And my ability to have some part in trying to make that work better has really been the great honor and highlight of my career.
Well, we have a couple of listeners who'd like to hear what your visions are for the future. John tweets, "What are the plans to adjust to a higher population, such as in my neighborhood, where thousands more will soon live?" This listener writes, "What will the future of transportation in San Francisco look like 5 years, 25 years from now? Will there be more subways? How will autonomous vehicles come into play? What will it take politically, economically to take us there?"
Yeah, so those are great questions. A few years ago, as we were contemplating those same questions, we initiated a long-term transportation planning process called Connect SF. And through that process, we've been trying to really look at where the growth in the city is going to be happening, what changes in technology are going to happen within the transportation system to the extent we can predict that, which is very difficult to predict. And then trying from that information to develop, you know, what our path forward should be. So I don't know what all the answers are. We have folks that are looking very closely at autonomous vehicles and their potential to impact cities like San Francisco. We have a lot of transportation planners looking at where future subways might be warranted based on future projected ridership. And there's some talk about a large funding measure in the region that might help us achieve some of those goals once we identify where those new subways are going to be and what those new policies need to be.
And so you will be here for the long term. You've worked out some of the concerns from Mayor Breed about transportation.
I come into work every day and with a fresh perspective, and we'll keep doing so until it's time to move on.
Ed Riskin, he's Director of Transportation for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Thank you for joining us this morning and taking our calls.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Mina.
I'm Mina Kim. Thanks to our listeners for participating as well, as always, and have a great weekend. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.